Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. The program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, as usual, we're going to try to do justice to various topics that involve threats to our country, both foreign and domestic. Among them are some that are decidedly complicated, because it would seem as though people who wouldn't get along are nonetheless making common cause for the purpose of harming our country. We've come to call this the Red-Green Axis at the Center for Security Policy, and we have a wealth of books and other content on this subject. If you're interested in learning more, I encourage you to go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org you can find many of these books available for free as downloadable PDFs. Support the work we do there, if you would, at our donate page. One of the bodies of work that we're most proud of, both in terms of the center's library, but also the broader content of one of our senior fellows by the name of Robert Spencer, is his work on the Red-Green Axis, both the communist piece of it and the jihadist piece, most obviously. These are subjects that he addresses brilliantly at his online resource, jihadwatch.org. He is also a columnist with Front Page Magazine, as well as PJ Media. And I'm just so proud to be able to call him both a friend as well as a mentor on so many of these topics. Robert, welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you with us, especially at a moment when we desperately need your clarity and insights into what we're confronting on, well, places like the campus of Columbia University and many others across the United States. Good to have you, sir.
It's always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
So, Robert, I think Columbia is just the leading edge, it seems, of a larger phenomenon. And this Red-Green Axis appears very much in evidence there. Talk to us about how it is that atheist communists could be making seemingly very, very aggressive common cause with theocratic Sharia supremacists.
Well, they both hate Israel, and they hate Israel for different reasons, but because they have this common hatred, they can make common cause. There are a number of reasons why they both hate Israel. One is that from its beginnings, the modern state of Israel has been identified with the United States. They hate the United States. They consider it to be the foremost opponent of the socialist internationalist order that they want to establish. Another is that they are collectivists. They are internationalists who want to establish what they call equity, which essentially means the erasure of all differences between human beings. It sounds noble, but it's actually insidious. As we saw, for example, I think the quintessential example of it, Frank, is Mao's China, where everybody had to wear the same clothes. Because even if we had different clothes, it would introduce inequity between us. Your clothes might be nicer than mine, and so on. And so the idea is to erase all distinguishing characteristics of the individual. Now, Israel is a very particular state. It's the Jewish state, and that is an ethnic and religious individuality that the left hates because it wants to erase those kinds of distinctions between human beings. So that coincides perfectly with the Islamic Jihad imperative, which is that any land that belongs to Islam at any point belongs to Islam forever.
Yeah. Robert, is there also baked into all of this in both camps anti-Semitism as well? Is it more than just inequity as they see it?
Well, Islam is deeply anti-Semitic. A lot of people don't realize that, but the Quran in chapter 5, verse 82, says that the people who have the greatest hostility to the Muslims are the Jews. And this translates in reality to the Muslims having the greatest hostility for Jews. The Quran is also full of all kinds of anti-Semitic material, including the transformation of disobedient Jews into apes and pigs, which is something that jihadis commonly repeat today, and so on. Now, a lot of people don't know, but the left also has a deep strain of anti-Semitism going back to Karl Marx and Karl Marx's treatise on the Jews, where he identifies Jews with capitalism and says that because Jews are the capitalist order, the Jews and Judaism have to be eradicated in order to establish the socialist paradise. And this is something that Stalin was implementing as he was, at the time of his death. He was instituting a large-scale pogrom of the Jews in the Soviet Union. A lot of people don't realize this, but this is another reason why the left and Islam make common cause so easily.
And especially when they have an immediate objective in common, which is, as you say, not only destroying Israel, but Western civilization, Judeo-Christian civilization, and most especially what they call the Great Satan in the case of the Islamists, and just the, you know, bourgeois capitalist enterprise, the United States, according to the communists. And let's come back to specifically what's going on these college campuses, notably Columbia, Robert. Is this simply the latest manifestation of all of these phenomena, or is there something special about what's going on here that we ought to be alive to?
Well, it certainly is the latest manifestation of an orchestrated effort that seems to have been well planned in advance of October 7th to discredit Israel and to destroy the alliance between the U.S. and Israel. And Frank, people should make no mistake, these are not spontaneous student-led demonstrations. These are very clearly something that is being financed by a hidden hand. We don't know who's behind it. But take, for example, the fact that in these encampments on college campuses that are demanding divestment from Israel, the rejection of Israel in various ways, including Columbia, all the tents are the same. All these students that decide to camp out until the U.S. disavows the alliance with Israel, they're all in these green tents that are identical. It's not as if they all showed up spontaneously with their own gear. They were obviously been issued this equipment by someone who paid for it all.
Yeah. Another symptom of this is when you see some pop-up demonstration and all of the signs are pre-printed and, you know, essentially identical. It's what they call in the intelligence business, Robert, a clue that, you know, there is indeed, as you say, a hidden hand. And we could speculate on which one it is. A personal favorite of mine in terms of a theory as to who's a driving force behind these things is an outfit that you've spent a lot of time studying and exposing in its various operations, and that would be the Muslim Brotherhood. What are we seeing in terms of the brothers' engagement in these demonstrations, the infrastructure, the personnel that they can bring to bear, some of whom seem to be being bussed in from, I don't know, Islamic centers and the like around the country?
Frank, yes, there's a heavy involvement of Muslim Brotherhood-linked organizations in the United States, the Muslim Students Association, Students for Justice in Palestine, of course, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. They're all wholeheartedly in favor of these demonstrations. They are aiding them in any way that they can. And consequently, it does seem as if this is all in service of what we know to be, thanks in large part to the efforts of the Center for Security Policy, the overall goal of the Muslim Brotherhood, according to that notorious captured document calling for the elimination and destruction of Western civilization from within. And
there, yes, the explanatory memorandum. A very quick read, folks, and available, again, for free at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Please check it out. In just a few pages, you will see what the brothers are all about. Robert, you're very kind to compliment our work when we get back. Compliment yours. We'll be back with all of it and more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In July 2020, candidate Joe Biden promised Sharia supremacists that in exchange for their votes, he would appoint Muslims to staff his administration. Moderate Muslim Zudi Jasser warned shortly after the start of the Biden presidency that it was, quote, a Trojan horse that concealed the extent to which the red-green alliance of the far-left progressives and Islamists are being given the reins, unquote. The result has been nothing short of disastrous for our country, its Mideast allies, especially Israel, and vital interests abroad and increasingly at home. Look no further than Columbia University. The Biden Islamist latest success is a new State Department report on human rights practices. It treats Israel as a worse human rights abuser than China, Russia, Iran, and the Taliban. This monstrous lie is yet another gift to jihadists who seek not only death to Israel, but death to America. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Robert Spencer. He is both a dear friend as well as incalculably important national resource on matters involving, both sides, I would argue, of the red-green axis. He specifically has been renowned, in some areas reviled for sure, but renowned nonetheless for his scholarship about Islam and its tenets and Sharia, its sort of operating code and jihad, which it commands. And I cannot recommend highly enough the body of work that Robert has compiled in this space, among others, some 28 books, I think, at last count, but that is 2 weeks out of date, so there may be yet another one in the mix. But I know there's another one in the pipeline, that's for sure. But Robert, we've been talking about Columbia University as an example of what's been happening in college campuses across the country now, increasingly, and not least some cities in which these guys are now blockading traffic or otherwise acting up. You've helpfully explained how it is that communists, Marxists, progressives, whatever you want to call them, and jihadis are making common cause there and elsewhere. I wanted to ask you, because you and our dear friend and colleague David Horowitz have recently published a piece that I thought was profoundly important because it kind of puts in a spotlight the policies of the Biden administration that are at work here, I think, as well. Not just the obvious stuff about, you know, trying to appease Muslims in Michigan, for example, a key swing state in the upcoming election, about the administration's so-called pro-Israel policies. But more generally, the role that we're seeing played in shaping policy towards these guys by the Biden administration and what I call Joe Biden's in-house jihadis. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, the Biden administration is deeply infiltrated. It's very clear. He promised Engage, a Muslim Brotherhood-linked political organization that is dedicated to having Muslims run for office at all levels of government and getting as many into government as possible. He promised them in 2020 that he would appoint Muslims to every level of his administration. So we see Muslims at very high levels of the Biden administration who have ties to these Muslim Brotherhood organizations, including the chief negotiator, Hadi Amer, between Israel and the Palestinians for the Biden administration, Maher Bitar, then the Iranian-linked Arian Tabatabai. There are many others. And they have clearly influenced the administration's policies in a direction that is hostile and inimical toward the alliance between the U.S. and Israel. And of course, then there are the threats from outside, from Rashida Tlaib, the congresswoman from Michigan, and Nihad Awad of the Hamas-linked Council on American Islamic Relations, that the Muslim vote would not go for Biden this November unless he forces Israel to stop fighting and allows Hamas to survive. And of course, they're very worried about that. And so it all comes together into a massive betrayal of Israel, most recently in the 2023 International Human Rights Report, where Israel is lumped together with real human rights violators, including Russia and Iran.
And in your piece on this, you, I think, make the case that what is going on is a symptom of the influence that is being exercised. It's hardly the only example, but I have to say, Robert, it is so over the top that the government of the United States would describe one of its closest allies as having a worse human rights record, at least in the way it's treated in this report, than places like China or Iran or Russia, for that matter. I mean, what's going on here strikes me as not just an influence operation, but something that is absolutely toxic. And, you know, when you do look overseas, is manifesting itself as well in a betrayal of Israel there in ways and under conditions that are going to, I fear, conduce to its a mortal threat to its existence. Your thoughts, sir?
Absolutely, Frank. Yeah. The treatment of Israel in this new human rights report puts it on par also with the Taliban, where, of course, women are the supreme leader of the Taliban just announced that women will be stoned to death and subjected to various other punishments. And Iran, of course, is at war with its own citizenry, a war which began with the arrest of a woman for not wearing her hijab properly and her very suspicious death in the custody of the Iranian Sharia police. And so to put Israel on a par with regimes of that kind is very clearly a signal to the enemies of the United States, as well as to the friends of the United States, that the United States is not a reliable ally, that it's driven by electoral expedience, and that the leftists who are in power in Washington today have no interest in maintaining the traditional alliances that the United States has had since the end of World War II.
Yeah, in the Middle East, most especially. And it's not, again, just Israel that is being, I think, betrayed. But we've seen in a succession of reasonably friendly Muslim nations as well, very bad treatment at the hands of this Biden team. One further insight into it is, I think you know, Robert, the United States administration has recently been noodling the idea of sanctioning a brigade of the Israel Defense Forces, a brigade that happens to be engaged in combat at the moment in Gaza and in northern Israel against Hezbollah and on the Golan. And this apparently arises from charges that have been advanced by a group called Dawn, which I confess I'd never heard of before, but apparently has been stood up by Robert Malley and people like him or his associates. The board chairman of this group, which has been claiming Israel's brigade, the brigade in question, has been engaged in human rights abusive on an epic scale, is none other than the man you mentioned a moment ago, Nir Awad, arguably the top Muslim brother in the United States. Does this surprise you that we're seeing something as I believe, just catastrophically ill-advised as... Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to call them human rights abusers. It's another to actually reach in and try to disarm effectively, or certainly disable, a key element of Israel's national security defenses.
Yeah, Frank, you know, in the first place, we have to see this against the backdrop of the fact that the Biden administration has given sanctions relief to Iran that has enabled it to recover $10 billion since October 7th. That's aside from the money that they've sent before October 7th to Tehran. But $10 billion since October 7th means essentially that the United States is bankrolling the Hamas war against Israel, because Iran is bankrolling Hamas. And so you have, on the one hand, the United States about to sanction this IDF unit, and on the other hand, it's sending billions over to Iran and relieving Iran of the sanctions that ought to be enforced against that regime. So that's...
Robert, hold the thought, please, because I've got to take another short break. We'll be right back with more with Robert Spencer, the author, among other things, of the Politically Incorrect Guide to Muhammad, and a new book along those lines that is in the works, as I understand it, as well. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we have an extra segment with our friend Robert Spencer. Robert, I owe you an apology. I garbaged your book about the politically incorrect. You're focused on Islam, not just its prophet, Muhammad, but you have a new book coming out, Muhammad, A Critical Biography, that is available for pre-order right now. So forgive me for melding the two into one. They're separate, but also each of them in their own right can be extremely important contributions to our understanding of what we're up against in terms of, well, specifically, I believe, the Sharia supremacism that is much in evidence these days elsewhere, but also here. And that's what I wanted to come back to you with, Robert. We've talked a little bit about Columbia University. We've talked about the red-green axis. We've talked about the fact that it's not confined to campuses, though it seems to be spreading to more and more of them by the day. But I'm interested in your thoughts, Robert, as to whether what is now developing in this election year, as we saw in 2020, is the makings of a kind of color revolution that would, well, in this case, be taking place in a Democratic presidency, not a Republican one, but would presumably be focused on trying to destabilize the election and prevent Donald Trump's return to the White House, among other things. Would you agree that that's what is now seemingly not only a possibility, but actually in the offing, Robert?
Yeah, I think very much so, Frank. We're at a very dangerous point. One indication of this that I think has been given insufficient attention is the fact that Biden has a healthy lead in the polls right now. And I think, oh, come on, this is absurd. the damage that he's done to the nation over the last 3+ years ought to be obvious to everyone. Now, I know that a third of the electorate is never going to budge and will vote for a pigeon if it's got the Democrat after his name. But the Biden administration is singularly damaging, inept, failed, and so on. And it seems clear that if he has a substantial lead, this is preparing, this is just laying the groundwork for electoral shenanigans that will ensure that the Democrats remain in the White House. And what we're seeing is, over the last few years, is the hollowing out of America's institutions so that they appear to be still in place and the free society still intact, while the opposition is actually steadily being criminalized, marginalized, and silenced.
Well, we're certainly seeing more and more of that latter point. Just in the past 24 hours, we've had a whole nother cast of characters associated with Donald Trump indicted by a grand jury in Arizona. And the former president's own trials are proceeding apace, two of them going on simultaneously, as it happens at the moment. It's truly an environment in which it seems as though anything goes. And I figure that's a function of the totalitarian playbook of both the communists and the jihadis, the Muslim Brotherhood, notably, the Iranians as well. And speak to that a little bit, Robert, because you've studied both closely. When you you look at the opportunistic characteristics of both of these ideologies, especially as they are in a mutually reinforcing mode at the moment, would they see this as a window of opportunity, shall we say, to engage in even violent behavior with a view to not discrediting or disabling the current president, but assuring his victory?
Absolutely. Look, we saw it all through the summer of 2020. I expect this summer will be equally violent if those who are sponsoring that kind of behavior think that it's necessary in order to intimidate Americans into thinking that they have to vote the Democrats in again, or else there'll be widespread national unrest. The left does all this violence and gets off, so there's no downside for them. They don't face any prosecution. There's no bogus insurrection trial when it comes to Antifa or Black Lives Matter. And so I expect we'll be seeing them quite actively in the coming months.
And you've mentioned, too, that we're prominent in the 2020 revolutionary activity. And you are clear that they would be in the mix now. It's not obvious from, you know, a superficial glance that those are people directly active in this campaign on the campuses and the like, but they're definitely in the wings, if not, you know, pulling the strings, as they say. But just to tease this out a little bit further, we had a Republican president who was clearly the target of much of this activity. I was inclined to call it insurrectionist activity, right? The Democrats, who were not in the White House at the time, were supporting, by and large, certainly giving a pass to their friends on the radical left and in the green part of the red-green axis to some extent as well, certainly the black part of it. And yet you think that in a circumstance that's different in the sense that the president of the United States is a Democrat and the sort of, I think, rhetoric has been a bit more reserved at the very least, if not actually somewhat critical of what these guys are up to from Democrats now in office, that it would still redound to their benefit if this kind of violent behavior emerges, and again, in the context of a threat that worse will befall the country if they don't re-elect these guys. Is that basically how you see this working?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about the media spin and who controls the narrative. And so in this case, if Antifa and Black Lives Matter are out there rioting this summer, it will be blamed on Trump. And it will be another...
The prospect of his coming back.
Yeah. Or something. We also have to remember in this context that Christopher Wray, the FBI director, and Merrick Garland, the attorney general, Biden himself, and others have all said repeatedly over the last 3 years that white supremacists were the biggest terror threat the nation faces. Now, this is howlingly absurd, but don't be surprised if we see false flag operations that are based on this. Lots of people have made fun of the Patriot Front, this group of alleged white supremacist terrorists that all parade around with their faces covered, and they're all dressed in the same way, and they're all young, fit men. And people say this is obviously got FBI agents on their day off or something. I don't know for sure, but I think why it is indeed suspicious that there are no old fat guys, that there is nobody outside the type, that it's all these young white men. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's some white supremacist event that can justify all the actions that the left wants to take, a la the Reichstag fire.
Yeah. You know, this is very much something I've been mulling too, Robert, and especially when you add into the mix people who are here in sizable numbers, who don't fit that profile, to be sure, but who could be called upon to engage in sabotage or worse, and have it blamed on, you know, white supremacists. I guess the only thing I would quibble about is whether those guys are FBI agents on their day off or whether they're doing their day job, you know, because that seems to be what we saw, certainly agents provocateur, who seem to have some sort of attachment to the FBI on January 6th, among other episodes like this. Robert, let me just ask you quickly about two other things that are, again, back in your wheelhouse about Sharia supremacism. One is, we had a brief visit the other day with your colleague at jihadwatch.org, Christine Douglas Williams, about a line item that's been introduced into the Canadian government's budget to fund Sharia finance mortgages. And this is all being done in the name of, you know, trying to provide more housing in Canada. But it seems as though that's kind of a tell as to a further act of submission by the Canadian government under Trudeau to, well, their enemies, I would argue, and ours. There's also a fashion thing happening of it's described by, I think it's the BBC I was listening to this morning, as a modest fashion. All these, I would suggest, seem to have in part a kind of supremacist demand for submission in the mix. Quickly, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, Frank, in Canada, it's all about 2025, just like here, it's all about 2024. Trudeau is looking to get reelected and stay in power. And so he is courting the Muslim vote that he, of course, has brought into the country in his mass migration policies. And so the Sharia finance is an appeal to them, a reminder to them that they should stay on the reservation and vote for his party. At the same time, also, it gives a further foothold into the Canadian government for Muslim Brotherhood linked organizations, because just as here, they are the ones who actually control how the thing is worked.
Yeah. Robert, we have to leave it at that. We're out of time, but we'll come back to you on fashion and other issues. But thank you, my friend, for this wonderful interview. We'll talk with you soon. Keep up the great work at jihadwatch.org. God bless. We'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Bryan. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In July 2020, candidate Joe Biden promised Sharia supremacists that in exchange for their votes, he would appoint Muslims to staff his administration. Moderate Muslim Zudi Jasser warned shortly after the start of the Biden presidency that it was, quote, a Trojan horse that concealed the extent to which the red-green alliance of the far-left progressives and Islamists are being given the reins, unquote. The result has been nothing short of disastrous for our country, its Mideast allies, especially Israel, and vital interests abroad and increasingly at home. Look no further than Columbia University. The Biden Islamists' latest success is a new State Department report on human rights practices. It treats Israel as a worse human rights abuser than China, Russia, Iran, and the Taliban. This monstrous lie is yet another gift to jihadists who seek not only death to Israel, but death to America. This is Frank Affney. We're back. Dr. Stephen Bryan, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, is in the house. We're very pleased to have him always, but especially at a moment when we have need of his insights drawn on a wealth of experience in the government of the United States at very high levels, including as a deputy undersecretary of defense back when men were men in the Reagan administration when we worked together in the Pentagon. He has also been a very senior staff member in the U.S. Congress and a leader in the defense industrial sector as president of Finmeccanica USA. It's great to have you with us, Steve, as always, but especially in light of some recent developments in the space that you've been very active on, and that would be Ukraine. Good to see you, sir.
Good to be here.
So we just saw the Congress, after much to-ing and fro-ing, approving some $62 million, I think it was, for further aiding the Ukrainian resistance to Russia. And I know you've taken a dim view of all of this. Tell us your thoughts as to what this means, what it will likely translate into, if anything, for the prospects for a different outcome in Ukraine than you've been forecasting, which is Ukraine's defeat.
Well, it's still going to be defeated. I don't think there's going to be a change in the war that's dramatic. It'll prolong it. I think that's the real message of the money. And it will make it more difficult for the Ukrainian leaders to make deals because, you know, they're going to under pressure from the United States to stay in the war. There's a lot of false information about all this, but I think that the U.S. wants this war to continue. It certainly doesn't want to see Ukraine defeated. I think everybody would agree on that. But by the same token, it doesn't want to negotiate a deal with the Russians. This is an anti-Russian operation from start to finish.
Right. And you are, I believe, of the camp who believes that the Biden administration sought that from the get-go, as you've just indicated.
And the Obama one before that.
And Obama before that. The impression that I have had, Steve, is that they have actually been, for a period of time at least, accommodating to Moscow. There was a moment when Biden said, as long as it was a minor incursion, it would be okay. And he was volunteering to get Zelensky out of Ukraine when the invasion did begin, all of which seemed to bespeak a desire to get along, shall we say, with the Putin game here. You disagree?
Yeah, I do. I don't remember that. Not at all.
Well,
but maybe you're right. I mean,
both are matters of record. He said that before the invasion,
Well, they were trying to talk the Russians out of invading.
But that seemed to really be a flashing green light rather than a deterrence. But the idea of telling Zelensky once the invasion began, you know, we can get you out of there. And he said, I don't need a ride. I need more weapons. And from that point forward, I think it went much the way you've described.
Yeah, maybe they panicked a little bit. There was the Russians put a pretty large force into Ukraine after warning us and saying, you know, we ought to figure this out and find a solution, which the U.S. turned down. Now, remember, there were two letters sent by Putin in December 2021, late December 2021, one to President Biden and the other one to the Stoltenberg, who was the head of NATO. And both of them said, in principle, you know, that we have security issues. These security issues ought to be resolved. We are ready to talk about it. How about having a conversation? And both Biden and Stoltenberg for NATO turned down the Russians, turned down Putin. So a month later, the invasion started. So I think we know that the Russians really didn't want to do this if they could find a solution. The big issue then and now hasn't changed, is the presence of NATO in Ukraine, which the Russians regard as a strategic problem for themselves.
And there's been talk out of NATO that is going to happen, though I'm not quite sure whether the Secretary General was speaking for everybody.
What's going to happen exactly?
Well, I think the Secretary General of NATO has said that they're going to admit Ukraine into the alliance. I don't know that everybody's agreed to do that, but he was making that representation, which was rather striking.
Yeah, I saw that too. But he says a lot of things which are off the wall, in my opinion. He's a kind of warmonger, and he's made that. He keeps pushing and pushing for more activist NATO pressing the Russians. The problem is the Russians press back, isn't it?
Yeah, they certainly have to this point.
And they're pressing hard.
Yeah, and Steve, one of the things that I always appreciate your insights into is the extent to which what they've done with this, basically a debacle, I think, for their purposes for some time, is to sort of jujitsu it into a very considerable rebooting of their military-industrial complex, for want of a better term. Is that how you see it, that we're looking at a better armed and far more capable Russian military as a result?
Well, the Russian military is 25% larger than it was when the war started. I don't know how much more weapons they have, but it's a lot. And they have the Russian military industry is on 24/7 timetable now. It's really producing a lot of stuff. And they don't seem to be short of anything. So it looks to me like, unlike the West, which is short of everything, the Russians are in pretty good shape from a supply point of view and from a troops point of view. So they're doing well.
Steve, I need you to hold for just a second. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I'd like to ask you about one of the elements that has been helping the Russians get through all of this, and that is Iran and our failed policy towards Iran. We'll be right back with more right after that. Welcome back. We're talking with Stephen Bryan, a friend and colleague of many years, a man whose expertise on all things defense we appreciate greatly, as well as his service with us as a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. You can find out more about Stephen's work as well as ours at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. I urge you to check out the resources there. They're quite formidable, and moments like this especially needed. Steve, we were talking about, among other things, the state of play with respect to Russia and Ukraine. You were noting what the Russians have come out of this with, which seems to be a refurbished military industrial base and a lot of capability that is now being used to perhaps decisive effect in Ukraine, finally. I don't think I got from you really a sense of whether the money that we've just seen approved by the Congress after, as I say, much thrashing about, is going to make a difference or not, specifically whether it's advisable or not, I guess is the question, or inadvisable in your judgment.
Well, to the degree that it prolongs the war and it makes it harder to get a negotiation, it's not advisable. I think that's clear. But it's very hard to tell American politicians with an election looming to vote against aid of this sort, because they'll be blamed if Ukraine happens to be defeated while they're running for election. They're going to get blamed. So they voted for it. I don't think there's great enthusiasm for it at all.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a larger number of members who were opposed outright. But
for the first time, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. Yeah.
Obviously in favor. Steve, let me turn to a not unrelated topic. Among those who have been helping the Russians in the past year or so have been the Iranians, notably yes. with large quantities of drones and I think other military kit. You and your wonderful wife, Shoshana Bryan, with whom we've not spoken in altogether too long, yeah, we need to correct that, have written a piece recently that is about this policy more generally of the Biden administration towards Iran. I heard the Daily Caller recently. Talk us through what is your bottom line on the failed policies of this administration towards Iran and the knock-on effects, including their alliance, evidently, with Russia.
Well, no doubt there's an alliance between Iran and Russia. It's getting deeper. I suspect that the Russians will soon start delivering modern Su-35 warplanes to Iran, probably in the next month. So, yeah, I mean, that's bad news for the region, because it's a good airplane, and the Iranians are good pilots. So that's going to be an issue. The bottom line, I think, is that the Biden administration is in bed with the Iranians. I mean, that's really the only way you can explain it. How is it possible? You know, what are they doing? They're appeasing Iran, absolutely appeasing Iran. They're deterring Israel and other countries from confronting Iran. They allowed the Iranians to carry out a massive attack, I mean, a huge, massive attack of rockets, of missiles, of cruise missiles, of drones, and never really condemned the Iranians.
I mean, against Israel, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but never really did any. You know. Okay, CENTCOM did a good job. I'm thrilled with what CENTCOM did.
In terms of trying to help intercept.
Shooting them down. Yeah, 80 of them or so by CENTCOM, which was mostly U.S. Navy. But, I mean, the fact that it was done, and that CENTCOM, actually the commander of CENTCOM, went to Israel before the attack and coordinated with the Israelis is very good news. But I don't think that's the administration's policy. That's the problem. The administration's policy is to mollycoddle, appease, whatever you want to call it, the Iranians, and maybe worse, and give them money, billions of dollars. So it's irrational.
Well, if it were just irrational, it'd be one thing. I think what you and Shoshana understand very well is it's dangerous in the extreme, because
it exceedingly,
not least, is empowering the Iranians to do worse. And unfortunately, I think also emboldening them to it as well. And Steve, just a quick question to you. To the extent that, I mean, I've got a theory of what's going on here more generally. I call it World War Xi. And I think that Xi is one of the principal beneficiaries of this particular conflagration, just as he was of Ukraine, because among other things, it's depleting our capability to do much about any aggression that he engages in the Pacific, maybe even against us. To the extent that that's so, does the fact that we're watching more arms being expended, for example, in countering this Iranian attack, especially in those naval anti-ship, anti-aircraft, I suppose, anti-missile capabilities, which are, last time I checked, in somewhat short supply, that this is net-net a plus for our enemies, not for us.
Yeah, well, we've been doing this with Ukraine, too. I mean, it's part of the same story. Air defense systems have been badly degraded. We have less and less of them, and we have less and less missiles for them. And it takes time. I mean, look, it takes a couple of years to build a missile. I mean, that's the bottom line today. So we're leaving a gap here that endangers the United States, to put it simply. And I don't see any plan to fix that, actually.
No, Steve, and we're almost out of time, but just very quickly, it looks as though the new defense budget for 2025 is going to make massive cuts in lots of what we have right now.
Mean, consider the timing. You asked me earlier about, you know, Europe building up its capabilities and that sort of thing to deal with the Russians, which they're not doing, by the way. It's all nonsense. But we aren't doing it really either.
Right. Well, no, to the contrary. And we have to have you back, Steve, soon to talk about this. We are, in fact, more than, offsetting whatever improvements we're making by the retirements and other cuts. Steve Bryan, thank you for the work you do with us at the Center for Security Policy and so much more. Your lifetime of service to our country. God bless you, my friend.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate
you
very
bride.
Much.
Take good care. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again next time. Until then, that you will go forth and multiply.